For those of you who are not familiar with the story of Esther in the Old Testament, it's the only book in the Bible that doesn't directly name the name of God. And yet it is a book, as we have seen over the past 7 weeks, that very clearly is all about God and about God's providence in the world. We've been taken back in time to the 5th century BC, where King Ahasuerus is reigning on the throne of the world superpower, Persia. The Persian Empire stretches from India in the east to Ethiopia in the west, covering 127 provinces. And Ahasuerus is king over them all. And under God's providence, Esther, a Jew, is his queen. Now we've met Ahasuerus, we've met Esther. Esther has a cousin, Mordecai, some years older than she is. He is the one who has raised her. She's an orphan. He has taken care of her and has instilled in her a high regard for the God of Israel and a deep conviction with regard to obeying his laws and honouring him with her life. We've also met a man called Haman, not a Jew, a Persian. Well, not really a Persian either. He's an Agagite. He's a descendant of King Agag, who was one of the great enemies of the Jews. And in the days of Saul, the very first king of Israel, the predecessor to King David, Agag was on death row. Saul had received commandment to kill Agag and all his descendants and all the nation there in the land of Canaan. But Saul had shown mercy towards Agag. He had refused to obey the God of Israel, and as a result, his kingship was taken away from him and was given to King David. Descendants came from King Agag, and Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, is one of those descendants. He's a mortal enemy of the Jews. Centuries after Saul should have killed his ancestor, this enmity continues. And that's really at the center of this whole story. Haman's hatred of the Jews led him to issue a decree using the king's authority, sealed with the king's signet ring, a decree to annihilate every Jew in the Persian Empire on a certain day, on the 13th day of the 12th month of this particular year in which these events are taking place. But we've also seen in the providence of God that Esther was brought into the palace as queen for this very reason, to thwart Haman's plans and to ensure the annihilation of the descendants of Agag. God's promises would be fulfilled, and we've seen God's sovereignty at work. And so last week we left Haman, not prime minister in Persia, not wearing a king's robe and riding on a king's steed. We left him hanging on a gallows 75 feet high that he had made for Mordecai the Jew. How the tables have turned. And now change is in the air. With Haman hanging, new hope is beginning to arise in Persia among the Jews that live throughout those 127 provinces. But they're still in a predicament. They are still on death row. The king's decree, written by Haman, who now is dead, still stands. So let us look at this passage in Esther chapter 8 and see how the story continues to unfold and see what changes are taking place in the land of Persia. Well, the first very clear change that takes place is a change in the administration. After all, the prime minister is dead. King Ahasuerus needs a new prime minister. Listen to what the narrator tells us in these opening verses. On that day, that is on the day that Haman was hanged on those gallows, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Haman was a traitor. Haman, though admittedly he didn't realize it initially, Haman had conspired against the queen. He had placed her on death row. Naturally, the king isn't too happy about it. Haman's lost his life. The king has his ring back. And he gives all the property of Haman to his queen, to Esther, to the person whom Haman had so greatly wronged. This wasn't just a small thing. We noticed earlier that Haman was a proud man and he liked to boast. And he boasted about all his wealth. Verse 11 of chapter 5, Haman told his family and friends of his great riches, of the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. He was a wealthy man, and all this great estate of the former prime minister of Persia has been handed over to Esther, who then makes Mordecai her faithful, patient cousin, manager over all her estates. I wonder what Haman would have thought had he known. That man who day after day he had to pass in the king's gate, a magistrate of Persia, who refused to pay him homage, and who he had in his great pride and arrogance determined to execute along with every other Jew in Persia, that man now has control of all his possessions. Proverbs 13 and verse 22 is very pertinent here. It says there, the wealth of a sinner is stored up for the righteous. How we see that fulfilled here. Haman's great wealth, he's lost it all through his greed and arrogance. And the queen now owns all his estate, and Mordecai is appointed over it all. But more than that, Mordecai is made prime minister in Haman's place. Mordecai, who had overheard a plot some years earlier, a plot to assassinate the king, and had made it known through Esther to the king, Mordecai, who had saved the king's life and who for years had remained unrewarded, is now advanced to prime minister of Persia. He has the signet ring. He has the power. What an amazing change of events have taken place. And more than that, as if this wasn't enough to put a stamp of shame upon the house of Haman, Mordecai is dressed in royal robes, not for a fleeting ride around the city, but permanently. In verse 15, we're told Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. Mordecai has what Haman longed for: royal garments and the crown, all the splendor of the king, something that Haman never, ever achieved. Everything that Haman in his greed had longed for, and through his greed had lost, becomes Mordecai's, his greatest enemy's. How things have changed in Persia. Overnight, literally overnight, one day Haman is prime minister. He has all the power, second only to the king. The next day, Haman's dead. Mordecai is prime minister. All in God's gracious and sovereign providence. God is at work in all of this. This is the unfolding story of the history of salvation. And we're to learn from all of these events. We're to consider carefully the life of Haman. What sort of man he was, so motivated by greed and by pride. We're to take careful note of that and to think seriously, how am I living? What motivates me? What drives me on from day to day? What are my goals? What are my ambitions? And what am I doing in order to achieve those things? See, Haman cared about no one but himself. Always boasting about what he had, what he had achieved, where he was going, what his plans were. Mordecai, on the other hand, was a very humble man. Didn't have great ambitions. Went from day to day, minding his own business, doing his job that he had been called to do, sitting there in the king's gate among the elders of the city, passing judgment upon the cases that we brought before him. Just carrying on, living an honest life, a humble life. He didn't want the limelight. He didn't want pageantry. He just did what it was right for a loyal citizen to do. And Esther, his cousin, tutored by him, gives us more evidence of what Mordecai himself would have done if it had been his calling to do it. He it was who had encouraged Esther, first of all, to go in to the king, though she had not been called. For, he said, who knows whether you have come to this kingdom for such a time as this? You're the queen. You have access to the king, albeit somewhat restricted. Who knows whether God has not placed you in this position for such a time as this? We see through these words that had Mordecai been in such a position, he himself would have risked life and limb to make known to the king the plight of his people. Haman was a man who was proud of his life and wanted advancement and glory and fame. Mordecai was a man who was willing to dispose of his life, to give it up, to save others, to help others, so that others might live. What a contrast in these two people. It reminds us of the words of the Lord Jesus Christ in Mark chapter 8, where he tells his disciples that they must take up the cross and follow him. He says, for whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world as it seemed Haman was on the road to doing, but loses his own soul. What profit is it? What will a man give in exchange for his soul? What price is high enough for someone to sell their soul? And Jesus goes on to say, whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. We should take note of this. Are we going to follow in the steps of Haman, who by this world's standards was making a life for himself? Or follow in the footsteps of Mordecai and of Esther, willing to lose their lives for the sake of the glory and honour of God? You want to save your life? You want to have a full life in this world? You risk losing your soul. But you be willing to sacrifice, as it were, your life in this world to honour Jesus Christ, to serve Jesus Christ. And God promises that your life will be saved. Mordecai and Esther are given to us as examples that we should follow in their footsteps. But there's other changes taking place. Not only changes in the administration. Haman gone. Mordecai in a position of power. But now, something needs to be done about these laws. The Jews are still, in a few months' time, going to be slaughtered by the decree of the king, which the king himself says cannot be changed. It is whatever is written in verse 8, in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke, not even the king. It would seem as though they're in a helpless situation. The law says that on the 13th day of the 12th month, the Jews will be slaughtered. That law cannot be removed. It cannot be annulled. It cannot be revoked. So what can be done? And here we see the great wisdom that God has given to Mordecai and to Esther. In an amazing act of trust, the king has given his signet ring to Mordecai and instructs Mordecai and Esther to draft a law. He wants nothing to do with it. You yourselves, he says, write a decree concerning the Jews as you please, in my name, and seal it with my signet ring. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke. He's done it once, and he's willing to do it again. Here again we see the incredible sovereignty of God, that this man, yes, he's had his life saved by Mordecai. Yes, he's learned to trust Esther the queen. He's seen all her good qualities that go far beyond physical beauty. And yet still, it's an incredible thing that he would entrust such power to these people who have been so wronged and could use that power to retaliate in a major way that no one could undo, that no one could revoke. God's hand is here in the trust of the king, in Esther and in Mordecai. And that trust, this time, is honoured. That trust, this time, is well placed. Esther goes into the king once again. Pleads for her people. Once again, she risks her life. Once again, the scepter is extended to her. Her life is spared. and she pleads for her people. If it pleases the king, if I have found favor in his sight and the thing seems right to the king and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? Her life has been spared. After all, after seeing what happened to Haman, who else in Persia on the 13th day of the 12th month would dare to lay a finger on Queen Esther? Her life was already saved, in effect. But she's not satisfied. She wants the lives of her people saved. And so she receives this request, the answer, that the law can't be revoked, but you write a new law. And so they write. They sit down together, perhaps, and they discuss what needs to be done. What are they going to do to overcome this law which cannot be changed? And in the third month, the scribes sit down and they listen as Mordecai dictates a new decree sealed with the king's seal. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, and we're told these are the words that were written. The king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions on one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Look at the wisdom of these things. Of these words. Firstly, Mordecai and Esther could have just retaliated. They could have made sure that ahead of time there was a mass slaughter of Persians. Wouldn't have been many people left in Persia, but it would have served their purpose. The Jews would have been saved. They would have been the world superpower. Everything would have been fine from then on. But they don't do that. God wants justice. God is a God of justice. And his people desire justice. Mordecai was a man of the Bible. He was a man of the Old Testament scriptures. He understood that the Old Testament scriptures required justice. Even in removing all the people from the promised land, even in the slaughter of men, women and children that was decreed by God should take place, Mordecai recognized justice. Here were people who did not recognize God. This was a judgment of God upon the people in Canaan. That's how it's described to Moses. They are being punished. And God is giving their land to the people of Israel. After all, it's God's world to do with as he pleases. And being a just God, he is just and righteous when he destroys those who do not worship him and do not obey him. And as Mordecai understands these principles of justice, and he looks at their own situation, what would be more just and to turn the decree around upon the people who would attack the Jews. And so we find that the words are almost identical to the decree of Haman. But there are limitations. There's the limitation of time. The Jews may only fight on one day. The day when the law decrees that the Jews are to be slaughtered. They are to do so in a stance of defence, not offence. They are not to take the initiative. They are to barricade themselves They are to protect themselves, and if anyone does come against them to attack them, those people, and only those people, may be destroyed. But they may be destroyed. They may be killed, and they may be annihilated. Both the men who assault them, and their women, and their children, just as Haman's decree had said would happen against the Jews. Now, I know that some translations suggest that when it talks about women and children in verse 11, that it's talking about the women and children of the Jews. In other words, that when the forces come against the people, including the children and women, then the Israelites may defend themselves and kill whoever attacks them. Other translations, and I think it's more consistent with the Hebrew, suggests that those who are defending themselves may attack the men who come against them and the families of those men. That seems to be consistent with the way God has worked throughout the previous history of the Old Testament. And we'll look a little bit more at that next week, Lord willing. But here's a great change. There's a change in administration, and there's a change in legislation that enables the Jews to gather together, to defend themselves, and to return the desires of their enemies on their own heads. This is justice. This is the principle of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, and so on, that we find in the book of Exodus. This is appropriate punishment. And Mordecai is very careful to use prudence here when he has so much power. How he could have turned the whole empire of Persia against himself and against every Jew in a moment. But instead, what do we find? That when Mordecai goes out from the presence of the king, clothed in royal apparel, with a great crown of gold and garments of fine linen and purple, the city of Shushan, the whole city of Shushan, Jew and Persian alike, rejoiced and was glad. Remember how confused they had been earlier? When the decree of Haman had gone out, the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan were perplexed. They were confused. Now the whole city is rejoicing and glad. Why? Before they could see the injustice of what Haman had decreed. Now they see the absolute justice of what Mordecai has decreed. And so we see another change take place, and that is a change in allegiance. In every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness and a feast and a holiday. And then many of the people of the land became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them. Now it's very probable that many of those who became Jews did it for pragmatic reasons. It appeared to them to be the safest option. But notice something for a moment. I wouldn't think for a moment that all of these conversions were just for safety's sake, just because it suited them for the time being, and that they'd as soon convert back when all the trouble was over. Why? Well, because the trouble hasn't come yet. It's another 7 months away. They're only in the third month of the year. And it's not until the 12th month that these events are going to take place. It's a long way away. Plus the fact that the Jews are only permitted to attack those who attack them. Why would any law-abiding Persian have to worry, have to fear that the Jews would attack them? They had no reason to do so. It was really up to them whether they were in any danger or not. They attack a Jew, well, it's coming to them, isn't it? But if they don't, they just carry on about their daily business, or take a day off sick and stay home on that particular day, they'll be safe. The Jews aren't permitted to go rampaging through the cities, throwing open doors into people's homes, sticking swords through people as they lie in their beds. They're not permitted to do that. That's what the Persians are permitted to do against them. But they're not permitted to. So you see, really there's no reason why these Persians should convert to Judaism for safety's sake. It's very likely that some of these Persians look back over history and they know that God is with the Jews. He was with Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego in the fiery furnace. That story's only a few years old, you see. It will be remembered in the lifetime of some of these people who are living now. The story of Daniel in the lion's den. It's still known. It's still being retold by Persians to their grandchildren. Oh, I remember when Daniel, a wise man of King Nebuchadnezzar, was thrown into a lion's den. And the lions didn't touch him because the God of Israel was on his side. And now you see, people are being reminded about the God of Israel, about the great power of the God of Israel. After a few years, possibly a few decades of not much exciting happening for the Jews, suddenly, incredible things are happening. Incredible changes are taking place. And people are beginning to think, maybe we should be serving this God, who so clearly is more powerful than all the gods in Persia. Whether it be the gods of India or the gods of Ethiopia or any of the 125 provinces in between, this God is the all-powerful God. We will serve this God. So yes, there may well have been those who simply converted out of pragmatism. But I'm convinced there were also those who converted because they realized there is a God in heaven. And he works in this world. And so we will see later on in chapter 9 that when all the feasting begins to take place, it talks about those who have joined themselves to the Jews. It's all over, but they're still there, joined to the Jews. Great changes in administration, in legislation, and in allegiance have taken place in a matter of days. What a wonderful thing we see in God's sovereign power in Persia. Now, what do we learn from this? Well, I've already indicated that we must be ready to give our lives for the sake of Jesus Christ, to lay down our lives for his glory. That's what Mordecai, that's what Esther were both willing to do. Because it was right, not because it would necessarily be good for them, but because it was the right thing to do. I've already indicated that justice is something that is of prime importance to the living God. That God always acts in justice. And one day God will come injustice in the person of Jesus Christ, and everyone in this room and everyone in this city and everyone in this world will stand before his throne of judgment and will have to give an account for the way that they have lived. And many, like Haman, will be cast off from the presence of God forever. and others like Mordecai will be advanced. For those who humble themselves, God will exalt. And so we must be ready to stand for what is right, to stand up for justice. And we must be ready to live for God. Even though we may recognize that it's not going to do us any good personally in this life, it may bring all kinds of hardship and trouble to us, but that it's right because God wants it from us. He is our King. He is our God. We live for Him, knowing that He is eternally faithful. But let me speak in closing to those who do not trust in this God, who wouldn't call themselves Christians, or even if you do call yourself a Christian, you're not or haven't been ready to give your life wholly to serving God, to doing what He wants. Observe the hand of God here in this story of Esther. Notice what the Persians saw when they saw Haman on the gallows and Mordecai in robes. They saw God at work. And I ask you to pause in the busyness of your lives and to think about God at work. And to think about the justice of God coming to you. And think about whether or not your allegiance should change from serving yourself to serving the living God. If Jesus came back today, would you be glad or would you be sad?